All right, Noah, we're live. You're the first ever repeat guest on the Canadian Canoe Podcast, so welcome.
I'm honored.
I think you were number two, so.
Good to be back.
Man, nice to see you again.
Your beautiful house out here in Ketch Harbor.
You know, it's been a labor of love. Let's dive into it. You just finished a, what, 3 week?
We were out there for 30 days, so a little over 4 weeks.
Time flies. For some reason, I just felt like yesterday you were posting your like Instagram post talking about how you're going to disappear for a while. That's been over a month now.
Yeah, so I've been back for about 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And I still, my mind hasn't fully come back yet.
Tired, man, coming off a trip. It's like kind of depressing.
Yeah, I find these trips, before the trip, you spend so much time focusing on prepping for the trip. And then when you're out there, the goal is to finish the trip, right? And then when you come back, it's done. And you're like, well, now what?
Like, I find you like, you're like looking forward to getting back to civilization for like burgers and beer and like whatever those, you know, is it luring you back into wherever you're going? And I enjoy that. I get there and I like love it for like 24 hours. And then 24 hours comes and I'm like, oh, I'm ready to be back in the woods again. But by then you're like, you know, back on your phone and you got work emails to deal with.
Yeah. It's a short-lived time there when you're like, you do eat some good food when you get back and it's nice seeing friends and family. And then you're like, oh, well, what's next?
Yeah, for sure. So what was the trip? Where'd you go?
So we went back to Labrador, out in the Labrador Peninsula.
Yeah.
It was a 620-kilometer route starting in western Labrador. And instead of going across to the Labrador Sea, we took this route where we kind of worked our way through the Labrador Plateau and then down through Côte Nord down to the St. Lawrence.
So heading south?
Yes.
Did you start pretty close to where you started on your, what did you call your Boreal to Barrenlands trip?
Boreal to Barrenlands. Yeah, so
you rode the rail line up.
Yeah, so if you want to access this area, there's pretty much one way you can do it, and that's by the Tewatin rail line.
Yeah.
But we started about 300 kilometers south.
On this trip.
Yeah, but we took the same rail line that we did last time.
Right, is that the one where you just tell the conductor, like, let me off at kilometer whatever?
Yeah, so it's based on miles there. So we're getting dropped off at mile 187.
Cool.
But along the way, there's also, so there's stations along the way that are manned 24/7. I'm not exactly sure what they're used for, but it's like a maintenance stops. And the one that we stopped at was called Orway.
Okay.
And when we arrived, there was a full group of workers there doing their thing. And we portaged all our gear right through the middle of the work area.
Right on. Yeah. That's cool. Were they like wishing you good luck?
Yeah. I think the only people they see out there is canoeists.
Right.
So it's not like a new thing
for
them to see, but they're always curious to see where you're going and how long you have out there.
Cool. So then that puts you like that drop off is like, if you're looking at the Labrador Peninsula, kind of like a big triangle, it's what? Central, south central, but a little bit south of dead center.
Yeah. So can you picture where Labrador City is?
For sure. Yeah.
So south of there.
Right.
Directly south of there, pretty much.
And then you're paddling basically due south to the St. Lawrence?
No. So the most iconic river on the North Shore is the Moisey.
Right.
And
I've heard of the Moisey.
Yeah. It's called the Nahanni of the East. Right.
Cool.
Because there's huge
gorges and stuff.
Huge gorges, big white water, beautiful scenery, and logistically really easy because it runs essentially parallel to the Tewatin rail line.
Right.
So you could literally start at Septil on the St. Lawrence.
Yeah.
Take the rail line up
and end at Septil.
And then paddle down the Moisey back down to Septil.
Right.
So but the north shore of the St. Lawrence is the Laurentian, there's the ancient Laurentian mountain range, which is the root system of an ancient mountain range that ranged all the way from Labrador to the Great Lakes of Ontario.
Oh, cool.
And because of that, there's still quite the elevation drop, mm-hmm. and there's all these rivers that pour off into the Gulf of the St. Lawrence, and they almost run parallel to each other.
Yeah, you look at a map, it's crazy. They're like every like 50 or 80 K, it feels like there's one dumping into the St. Lawrence River.
And there's so much to explore up there.
Cool. So, and you came down which one?
So we took the Agouniche River.
Okay.
Which I'm going to butcher these names. It's right beside Natashquan.
Oh, yeah. I've heard you talk about that.
Yeah, the Natashquan is a more well-traveled route. Mm-hmm. And it's about, I would say it was about a four-hour drive. It was about a four-hour drive east of Septeel.
Further east. You're almost at the end of the road.
There's probably about halfway.
Okay. Right. Yeah. Right. Cool. So that's where you ended.
Yeah.
Right. And so you start, you get dropped off, and are you in lake paddling for the first bit before you get into the river?
Yeah. So we kind of broke this trip out into two sections. So we had four guys on the route.
Right.
And two of the guys, Alex, who's my good buddy from back home, who we've done lots of trips with.
And co-creator at Northern Scavenger.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. The other Northern Scavenger guy. And our other buddy, Eric, could only get 2 weeks off work.
Right. They flew in.
That's they flew right. in.
Maybe that's why I thought your trip was shorter than a month.
Yeah. Yeah. So we broke it into two sections. So the fourth guy was my other good friend, Matt Balcom, who I work with here in Nova Scotia.
Yeah.
And this is his first big trip.
Oh, cool.
It was great. And we were able to have the full month to do the full route. So for the first 2 weeks, Matt and I we traveled about 350 kilometers across the Labrador-Quebec Plateau.
Right.
Which we then crossed over to the headwaters of the Aguiniche, mm-hmm. which we then meet Eric and Alex, who are getting flown in 17 days after Matt and I started.
Really? What's that reunion like? Like they're like, you're in full bush mode and they're like just getting into like coming out of civilized, like straight out of the city. Like what? Describe that that meeting.
Yeah. I guess like, so also I haven't seen Alex for a year and a half.
Really?
That because of COVID.
Yeah.
So that there's a lot of emotions because I haven't seen these guys for a year and a half. And, these are the first guys we also saw on our entire trip.
Yeah.
And they were coming in on the crux of the entire route. So bringing it back, Matt and I started on doing a lot of lake paddling.
Right.
So we're able to ease our way into this trip.
Right.
They're getting dropped off at the headwaters of the Aguiniche, which literally just starts spilling over,
right.
spilling over this mountain. And they went right from city life 24 hours before to like the middle, like the thick of it right away.
Yeah. I want to hear about the reunion, but I'm going to stop you right there. Like, when you started this trip, you're at what elevation? And then you end at sea level, obviously. Like the lake paddling, you're about how high above sea level?
That's a good question. I'm not too sure.
Okay.
So.
But you're up on, I do know that area is like a big plateau. Yeah. Like you're basically on the top of a plateau. And then the second half of that trip is a wild ride down to sea level.
Yeah. So we're going through an area that are the headwaters of a lot of the river systems that spill off that, the mountain range.
Yeah.
And it's relatively flat up there, but it holds a lot of water.
Right.
Just north of us was a small wood reservoir, which is this massive area that's being used, that's being diked.
Named after Joey Smallwood.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's this massive amount of water up there and these big lake systems that are connected by river systems and just full of spruce bog everywhere.
Right.
So it was almost like two totally different trips. The first part had its own challenges and its own triumphs. And then the second part it was like two-week trips almost.
Yeah. So yeah, when they fly in, like they're probably like full of nervous energy because they're about to like, you know, it's all, man, even like doing a relatively easy trip when you're like day one, you're always kind of nervous about like what's coming, but you're already like, you know, feeling comfortable having done 17 days in the wilderness.
Yeah. I find on these larger trips, it takes about a week to get dialed in
for sure.
And not just mentally, but physically too. And also figuring out your routine, like where everything fits in the canoe.
Yeah.
After a few days, after about a week in the canoe, you know, every spot, every piece of gear you have has a spot in the canoe where it goes.
For sure.
And it takes a while to figure that out and get yourself into the game. So yeah. So Matt and I were dialed in and then Alex and Eric were coming in and they had to go through that process that Matt and I started.
Right.
Two weeks earlier. But also those guys are beauties. They brought us cold beer.
That was my next question.
Fresh apples.
Sweet.
And ribs.
Ribs. Ooh, beer and ribs, man.
It was a great combo.
So good.
Yeah.
Wow. So day 17, beer and ribs. You're living it up.
Yeah. It was great.
Yeah. Were you, that was your one food drop, like no other food.
Yeah, we were totally self-sufficient for that trip.
Yeah, cool. And then from they meet you, and then went another 2 weeks down the river.
Yeah, so then the Aguaniche from the headwaters is about 260 kilometers.
Yeah.
And so one of the reasons why we picked this route was the lack of information on it, mm-hmm. which had a bit of a mysterious vibe to
it. This is what I love about you. Like, most people like canoe rivers that have good notes. You like find rivers that have like no information and then paddle them. Like, it's like my favorite thing about you and like your crew, man.
Yeah, it's there's definitely that appeal of the unknown. And so this river had that appeal. So as far as we know, that's at least documented online, there was a descent in 1985 by a man named Guy Dorr and his team.
Okay.
And then in 2009, there's another group of guys, Christian Houdon and a few of his friends.
Okay.
And we were able to find information from both those guys.
Right.
So I've actually been talking to Guy through email and Christian through Facebook.
Yeah, cool.
And they were great. They were able to provide some great information and give some heads up on some sections.
Yeah.
But other than that, it's not like we were able to find portages, and the small detail definitely was kind of,
yeah, they'll give
didn't
you the,
exist.
They'll give you the big dangers, but you got to figure everything else out.
Yeah. And that's what I love about these trips.
Is it a dangerous river?
I would say any remote river can be dangerous.
For sure.
But we definitely had to be consciously aware of the decisions we made out there. The biggest being wrapping the canoe, I would say, and just stranding ourselves.
Right.
Because we're all competent paddlers, but everyone can make a mistake.
Sure.
And being such a bony, steep river, there's a lot of opportunity to make mistakes. Mm-hmm. Or even make a small mistake, like fall and roll your ankle.
Right.
And then and that could cripple you out there. Yeah. That could just stop progress for you.
Right. Right. Is it gorgy, like the Moisey?
So this river, so Guy Dorr actually, he did a report back in 1985, and he called this river the most diverse and complete rivers of the North Shore.
Oh, cool.
And because of that, I learned that a big part of that was the fact that there are a lot of gorges. There's a lot of big drops and chutes and rapids, but there's also a lot of glacial depositions. So big sandbanks of meandering river, braided stream, and the diversity was constant. It was rapids, chutes, waterfalls, shallow sections of meandering river that you can just take a chill pill for a second.
Right.
And unclench your butt cheeks
yeah, <really? laughs>
until the next set came.
Cool. Clear water, too?
Yeah, I'd say it's pretty clear.
I haven't spent much time in Quebec, but... I forget the name of the river now. Man, it's like... It's in the Gaspésie, so not where you were. But man, it's like...
Oh, the Bonaventure?
It ends in... there's a big ski hill there. Pan Rouge is the ski hill. I forget the name of the town now. Anyway, it's not important, but the river was like, it's, you know, these beautiful kind of, it's like rolling. It's not, I wouldn't call them mountains, but like nice big rolling hills.
Yeah.
And it's like a braided gravel river with like crystal clear water, you know, it's gorgeous. Yeah. And salmon, it's a big salmon river.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jim Baird did he paddled it and like did a little mini series on it, and they pulled it. Him and Tori pulled it.
I think I'm probably pronouncing this wrong, but I think it's the Bonaventure.
Yeah, that rings a bell. I was a kid.
The Chick-Chock Mountains.
I did it with my parents and like Boy Scouts and stuff. I was like, you know, 13 or 14. But what was so beautiful about it is the water was like crystal clear. You know, you can like see, you're just like cruising over these like beautiful, you know, like granite, like little pebbles and stuff. And
yeah. It's so hard to figure out how deep the water is, you know?
Yeah.
It could be a foot, it could be 10 feet, you don't know.
Yeah. Cool, man. Well, highlights, any, without spilling the beans? Because I know you're going to be making, you filmed this whole thing.
Yes.
For Northern Scavenger.
Yeah, so quick plug. I run Northern Scavenger with my buddy Alex, and we filmed this trip, and we're going to be doing a video series that'll probably be dropping definitely this coming winter, like February, I would say. But yeah, so everything we talk about, we'll have visuals to back it up in the near future. But in terms of highlights, I would say that's a wide topic to talk about.
True. It's like, you know, anytime you like go on a trip and someone's like, give me the highlight. You're like, so hard when you've just done like a month in the,
yeah,
I should be asking better questions, man.
I find, I think the big thing is, especially at work and stuff, that when people aren't as tuned into what a canoe trip is, and they ask, like, oh, how was the trip?
Mm-hmm.
It's so hard to come up with that elevator pitch.
For sure. And every trip's different.
Yeah.
And it's so personal.
It's so personal.
That's the hard part. It's like, it's really, you know, you could kind of, could kind of be a boring trip, but, and it's the small things that make it, like, memorable for you, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, not really anything memorable for anybody else. Like, it doesn't have, nothing crazy has to happen.
Yeah, I would say I'm a big enthusiast of the type 2 fun.
Oh man. Yeah. I mean, the type 2 fun it's the best fun. Like I want to talk about our trip, the trip we did this summer. It was type 2 fun. Like, when we were doing it, we weren't really having fun the whole time. We were like, this is brutal. But I'm looking back at it now and I was like, man, that was cool.
I definitely want to hear more about that. You did one of the largest rivers.
The largest
river in Canada.
Yeah. So we might as well talk about it. I paddled the Mackenzie with my wife, just two of us, in a pack boat. You ever used a pack boat?
I've not, no.
Man, I'd never used a pack boat until this trip and I was so impressed. Pack boats, folding boats, fits into a hockey bag. And man, it's a capable piece of equipment.
Really?
Yeah. You know, I was a bit concerned, like, we used one because we flew into Norman Wells, which is like a town on the river, on a commercial flight. So we didn't charter a plane. Like, if you charter a Beaver or something, we could have flown our hard boat, but that would have been so expensive because it's pretty far from Yellowknife, which is where we have a house. So we flew in on a commercial flight, but then you're like limited to checked bags. So we got our hands on a pack boat, and I was a bit worried about it because, you know, they flex and like they're not great for flat water, of which the Mackenzie has like huge, long stretches of, it's a river, but it's like sometimes it's like 4 or 5 kilometers wide. So it's basically a big lake that's flowing at like 7 or 8 kilometers an hour. It's flat, but otherwise it appears to be generally flat. But it worked so good, man. I want to buy one now.
Interesting. I've always been a little skeptic of their ability, so it's good to hear firsthand.
I was also kind of skeptical leading up to the trip, but then super happy that, super happy that with how it worked.
So the river clips at a decent pace and you have no portages. How many kilometers were you doing a day?
The river is moving at about between 6 and 8 kilometers an hour. Our biggest factor was wind. Cause when you get the prevailing winds are northerly, which is and the river runs like kind of northwest, but basically north. So like your wind, your prevailing wind and your current are running in opposite directions. And when you get a wind like up above 20, 25 kilometers an hour and the current reacting against each other, you get standing waves that are like 2-3 feet high. You can't cross the river. You have to stay right and tight to shore. And man, eddies, like we would come up, the volume of this river was fucking crazy. We would like be in tight to shore because of winds. And then suddenly I'd find myself we'd find ourselves in an eddy that was like several hundred meters long by several hundred meters wide. Like the river would like, you'd come around a point or something and the current would be going suddenly the wrong way. And you'd be in an eddy that was like the size of 10 football fields or something. And then you'd be like, I gotta get out of here. Then the eddy lines would be so fucking crazy because the volume is insane, man. It's the biggest river.
Yeah.
What made it hard? Like, it's beautiful. Like, it runs through the Mackenzie Mountains. We started halfway. It's a 2,000 kilometer trip if you do it all the way, which, man, anyone who does this thing all the way is fucking hard. Like, because it's grueling.
Yeah.
We started halfway. So our trip was it. And we didn't end on the Arctic Ocean. We ended in Inuvik, which is like 250 kilometers short. So we did like about an 800 kilometer trip. But what makes it tough is it's like such a big river that it's like banks get all chewed up by the thaw every year. Like it freezes over in the winter, and then in the breakup each year, like its banks get like chewed to shit, and they're big high banks often. And as a result of that, like you can't really get up into the forest. It's got like these big like 30 or 40 foot high banks, so you're like camping down at river level, but it's like mucky. It's like a silty river, so you're like camping kind of always in like muck or like mucky type stuff, unless you want to drag your boat up like 30 or 40 all your gear up a 30 or 40 foot like steep high bank into then like bug hell, you know,
where the bugs not as bad down on
no because it was windy.
Okay.
And like I think in other years you get better gravel and sandbars and things to camp on, but we had like record high water, so like the river would just like be at the base of the bank, and there'd be like we spent so many nights camping on these like little patches of muck that were like the size of a pool table because that's all we could find. You know, and then we'd be winded out. We had a lot of days winded out. So like back to your initial question, you could do 100 kilometers on a good day, but there was a lot of days when it was so dangerous we just didn't move.
So you had wind days where you just stayed at camp.
You'd have like, we had a few days where like 50, 60 kilometer an hour had like northerly winds reacting with that current, where you have standing waves that are like 3 or 4 feet. And like, you know, we didn't have a spray deck. We were open boat. And even if you had a spray deck, it still would have been gnarly, man.
Hey, quick question for you. Are you someone who wants to be fit, healthy, and happy? And what if I told you you could get your dream body by simply just listening to a podcast? I'm Josh.
And I'm KG, and we are the hosts of the Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast.
Listen, we get it. Fitness isn't easy. Carbs, no carbs.
Just stop, okay? It doesn't have to be that complicated. And that's why we made this podcast. We get straight to the facts so you can become your best you.
So the way to check us out is click the link in the show notes or search Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast on any of the major podcast platforms. We'll see you soon.
So at these campsites, was there a lot of driftwood or
huge amount of driftwood. Yeah, tons of driftwood. But we were like above the Arctic Circle, 24-hour daylight. We did this trip when they were having the record heat wave in BC. That whole like heat wave extended up to where we were. So like we had a lot of days in the low 30s. Like you didn't even really want to have a fire, man. It was so hot.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that.
And the sun's just like beating down on you 24 hours a day. It's like the last thing you want to do is have a fire.
There's probably not much reprieve either.
There's not much reprieve. You know, you guess we swam quite a bit. But the river's silty. So like even if you swim, like you come out and there's like a film of like silt. That was the other thing. Like the silty river means that you can't really fish. There's lots of fish in the river, but they won't see your lure. Like you can put your hand... I could be sitting in the canoe and put my hand into the water. So, like, there's just water, like, up, like, mid-forearm, you know? That's how deep my hand's in the water, and I can't see my hand.
Really?
Yeah. That's how silty the water is. So the fish can't see your lure.
So you can't... How do the fish hunt there, then?
I think they mostly... there's, like, a lot of feeding off the bottom, I think. I don't really know. It's a good question. But they also... The good fishing is in the streams. There's, like, tons of streams that flow into the Mackenzie. And they're all, most of them are clear because they're flowing off the mountains. The problem we had is because the water was like several feet, if not meters higher than usual, that the silty water would like all these streams, which would normally just be flowing into the Mackenzie as like you'd be paddling by, were actually like to go get to the clear water, you had to paddle upstream in the stream, like sometimes a kilometer, which we did a few times. But you can only do like so much of that, you know. You're like, when you're trying to make kilometers, you're like, oh, I don't know. should we divert up that stream for a kilometer to maybe get some fish? It's like,
so you're pretty far up north. Did you have any crazy animal encounters up there?
That was one of the highlights. We saw grizzly bear. Only one bear sighting, but we saw a grizzly bear.
Close encounter with a grizzly bear?
No, thank goodness. We were just paddling along and it was on the shore and it was scared of us. Actually, we, the other time is we went to camp somewhere, and we like a night. It looked like a nice spot from the river, and there weren't a lot of nice spots. And we like beached the canoe, and as soon as I got like Rupa sat in the canoe, well, I just like went up to like go suss it out a little more. I could hear the bear like taking off and running. So like I didn't see the bear, but a few bear encounters. Moose, we saw moose, caribou, lots of bird life, but muskox.
Muskox.
Muskox are huge. You ever seen a muskox?
So are muskox the same as buffalo?
No. Muskox are like the size of a buffalo, but they have long, like dreaded hair almost.
Okay. I can picture that.
Yeah.
You saw a muskox?
We saw several muskox. They normally roll in like a herd, you know. We saw a couple herds, but they also occasionally, like, we only found this out later, but occasionally they'll just, like, the males will, like a juvenile male will separate from the herd, and that's when they're dangerous. And like one night, we did a lot of paddling at night because the wind would, even though the sun doesn't set, it like comes down pretty close to the horizon and everything cools off a bit, and like the wind generally does subside from like 10 p.m. to like 4 a.m. So there was, I'd say half of our days were paddling, like where we would be shipping off at like 9 or 10 p.m. and paddling until 4 or 5, 6, 7 in the morning. And we had paddled all night one night, and we camped at like on a less than desirable spot. And we were exhausted when we pitched the tent. And then we woke up in the morning to like rustling up in the bank, like at the bank, like just above us, you know, like I say like 20 or 30 feet above us. And I thought it was a bear, like just fucking around in the bush, you know? So like I got out of the tent and I'm just like, hey bear, like, you know, we're here. Like, you know, normally that works. Normally when you do that, they run off, you know, as long as you're not surprising them. And like, as soon as they realize there's people around, they normally run off. But this thing didn't run off. And I'm like, oh, shit, like, that bear's not really phased, you know? So I think I yell again or whatever. But you can kind of keep hearing, like, it rustling in the bushes. But I couldn't see it. And then, like, I'm just kind of keeping an eye on things. And then I just see, like, the brown fur. And I'm like, oh, fuck, it's like a big, it's grizzly, you know? And it doesn't care we're here. So I, like, load up the shotgun. We had a shotgun. I loaded up the shotgun and I fired a warning shot like over its head, and the thing didn't even flinch. And I was like, oh fuck, like Rupa, like just get ready. Like this, whatever this is, it does not care we're here, you know? And then I'm like, kind of like, you know, chamber another round, like getting worried at this stage, you know? This thing's like 30 feet away, but like in like all like thick alders, so I can't really see what it is. I can see the brown fur. But then it like comes out a little further and I just see the two like massive horns on its head. And I'm like, oh, it's not a bear at all. It's a bloody muskox. And we just like stare at each other for like, I don't know, 20, 30 seconds. And then he just like puts his head down and like keeps eating leaves.
He did not care at all.
He did not care at all. But that morning, we got out of there pretty quick. And we were like, if this thing charges, I was worried it was going to charge. Our plan was just to like get into the, like immediately run into the river because we were camping just a few feet from the river. It's like my thought process there is like, it can't charge me swimming, you know? You can probably swim faster than me, but at least
the
impact would have been less, you know? But yeah, we like packed up pretty quick. Like I kind of like stayed there with a shotgun while like Rupa packed up the tent and like got the boat loaded. But then later that day, we paddled into a community called Fort Good Hope, which is about halfway. We went through two communities on our trip. And this was the first one we went into, and we, like, met a whole... Man, shout out to Fort Good Hope. Best people. Like, we got treated so good there. And they're in the midst of a bad COVID outbreak right now. Like, just the last couple of days. Yeah, but we arrived there, and we told the people we were talking to at Fort Good Hope about it. And they're like, oh man, like you got lucky. Cause when they're solitary like that, that's when the males like go off to, they separate from the herd and they go off to like find a female and they get aggressive, you know? He's like, you guys got lucky.
So it would have, so I'm trying to think, like, it would have charged you as, it would have thought of you as competition or just out of aggravation?
I don't know. Like, I've heard that they're pretty tolerant of humans. Like, evidently, man, I fired a fucking 12 gauge round over its head and it, like, didn't care. But if you have dogs, they get super aggressive because wolves are their kind of their one and only predator.
That makes sense.
Yeah, so we didn't have a dog, thank goodness. And yeah, man, he was so docile. He like just eating leaves, man. And they're really big. They're like, you know, just imagine a big moose, but with like much longer, like hair that instead of being like, what's moose hair, like a few inches long? The hair on a muskox is like a foot or two long. It's like this big furry thing. I've eaten muskox too in Nunavut. It's really nice meat. But this, where we were south of Fort Good Hope because we were paddling it. We've paddled into Fort Good Hope that day, and which is super far south on their range. Like, they're not normally where that far south. And I guess from what we understand, they're every year they're working their way further south, and eventually they're going to meet the bison herds, which are still further south than where the muskox are. But like, that's like, people are wondering what will happen when they meet.
Do you think they'd mate and make a super animal?
Kind of like the, what's the grizzly polar bear mix called? Pizzly.
Pizzly?
Pizzly bear. Have you heard about this?
That doesn't sound that frightening.
I know. If you think about it, I wouldn't want to run into one, man.
Yeah, I feel like it needs a name to represent like the true power of a grizzly polar bear.
Yeah,
right. Pizzly kind of sounds like a...
It sounds pizzly.
Yeah, pizzly.
Anyway, that was the Mackenzie. We had a good trip. I just wouldn't paddle it again. It was like, it's so big, you know. It's what makes it maybe not the funnest river is because of like the sheer scale of it. You spend a lot of time like looking at the next point. And you're like, oh man, I can't wait to get around that point. We're going to get to see a new part of the river, you know? Problem is that next point is like 10, 15 kilometers off. It takes you like two hours to paddle there maybe. And then like, you get around the point, you're like, oh, thank God, you know, new view. But then the next point could be like 25 kilometers off. You spend 3 or 4 hours paddling there. Like just, man, your time, you get into this time warp where like everything just like slows down. Your days like unfold so slowly, you know? And just doesn't have great camping and like not great fishing, but then just what is going through is super beautiful. Like we didn't see anybody for other than in Fort Good Hope, we didn't see anyone for 800 kilometers. You're in a massive river, you know. There's so much space, and like you're in this first half of the trip in this beautiful mountain range, and yeah, great wildlife, and yeah, there's a lot of cool things about it. The people, like the you meet. Like the little towns, we went through Fort Good Hope and Sigachik. These like little tiny, Fort Good Hope's fly-in only. Sigachik you can drive to. But the people you meet in these little towns were super, super sweet. It had like it was a cool trip. Just a bit of a tough trip too.
Yeah, I can see that being mentally tough when you know where you're going and there's not much change in between.
It's so big, man.
Yeah,
there's times when the river was across like. 4 or 5 kilometers, and it's like not that exciting. Like there are bits of white water. We went through two sets of rapids, and it, man, going through rapids on a river that big's crazy. Cause like you're like in rapids, but then there's like you can see rapids like on the other side of the river that you like. You know, it's just like the scale of everything's
just a big volume,
just crazy big volume. You know, like rapids, but where the river itself is 3 kilometers wide. You know. So, like, depending on which side of the river you're on, it's, like, totally different set. Like, the environment is totally different.
How did you find the pack boats responded in the rapids?
They kind of flex, eh? They flex, which I think is good. Like, if you're going through, like, a set, you know, like, the boat is actually kind of molding to the shape of the water, like, the waves. This is why they're apparently not good on flat water, because every stroke you take, the boat does flex a bit, so some of your energy... is like goes into the boat flexing. So you don't like every stroke you take, instead of that being like energy that propels you forward, some goes into the boat each time it lurches forward with a stroke, it flexes a little bit. So your efficiency apparently is like 80, they say 80% of what you'd get with a hard rigid hull.
I would not have thought that. That's interesting.
Yeah. So I was like a bit concerned about that, and maybe I noticed it a bit, but to be honest, I didn't really notice it. And we were like, you know, that might be true. You'd probably notice it if you had an empty pack boat versus an empty rigid boat. When you have two loaded boats, like, you're not flying down the river anyway, you know, or flying across a lake. You know how it is. Like,
yeah,
when you're hauling like 100 pounds of gear or more. And like this trip, because it didn't have any portages, we like went heavy. We like ate great food. You know, we like, there was no point holding back.
Speaking of great food, so from based on your last trip, I packed a lot of shepherd's pie on this one.
Man, how was it?
It was amazing. It was one of the best meals of the trip.
So give me your shepherd's pie recipe.
So I bought the mixed vegetables, frozen vegetables.
Dehydrated them.
Dehydrated. Yeah. But I added barbecue sauce, some spices.
Mm, nice.
And then ground beef. So what I find is when you're cooking ground beef, there's fat in it, right?
Yeah.
And you don't want to dehydrate fat.
No.
So I don't fry it or cook it in a pan. I just boil it.
That's a good idea.
And all that fat kind of sort of renders to the top, and you can drain
it. Scrape it off. I do a similar thing. I cook it in a pan, and then I strain it in like a pasta strainer. And
yeah.
Rinse it with hot water. But boiling's actually a better idea.
It seems like a very unorthodox approach to cooking meat, because it just like takes all that flavor out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
But in terms of dehydrating ground beef, it lasts a long time, and that's the most important thing up there.
Yeah, and then I add the fat in at the end. I'll put like a spoonful of boiled butter or oil or something.
Yeah. Yeah, so we had the vegetable... ground beef combo, and then from your recommendation, the powdered mashed potatoes, man. The instant mashed potatoes.
Yeah, gravy. You use instant gravy too.
And the gravy was a perfect top. I've never done gravy before. And there's that magical moment where it is a total liquid, and then all of a sudden,
boom,
it renders into like this amazing, perfect gravy.
Yeah, that's the cornstarch in there, I think.
It is so good. And then we also had Frank's Red Hot Sauce too.
Oh man, yeah, you gotta have a little bit of that sauce. We had a Tabasco bottle of Tabasco, which didn't last the whole trip, man. Just Tabasco on everything.
I find sharp flavors are so good on these trips. You know, like you really appreciate flavor and texture in your meals are the two things.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, what were we eating? We had shepherd's pie also on this trip. A lot of like dips, you know, like, man, I took an oven. I took a folding oven and I was making fresh biscuits.
Folding oven, what do you mean?
So it's like a box. It's made by Coleman. They're pretty heavy. Like I would never want to portage a folding oven. It probably like this Mac in front of me probably folds into the size of the Mac, but it's a bit heavier. But it's basically like just imagine a box that then you can put on either a bed of coals or on top of a burner. We took like a proper camp stove, like a Coleman two burner stove. Which again isn't something you'd want to portage, but on a trip like this, it's really nice because you have two burners and you can like, you know, be cooking two things at once. And you just set it on top of either coals or a stove, and the box, and it has a little rack in it and a little door with a thermometer in it. Yeah, and we had like a little baking pan, and I would make a biscuit mix, baking fresh biscuits, not every day, but almost every day, and. Yeah, then, you know, biscuits and, like, nice dips, man, like hummus or biscuits with, like, we had, like, instant guacamole mix, which our friend Mark, shout out to Mark, he's got a buddy who's, like, pretty famous, like, Arctic, he leads, like, expeditions to the poles and stuff. Anyway, he had given Mark, like, all these, like, extra dips, and Mark gave some to us, so we like instant guacamole and like black bean dip and stuff.
It's delicious.
With fresh biscuits, man.
That'd be so good.
It was great.
I've never had a biscuit on a backcountry trip before. That's interesting.
Oh, and you put like, I took like dried herbs, so like, you know, like Italian spice.
Yeah.
Like sometimes you'd add Italian spice to the biscuit mix and you'd have like Italian biscuits or, I don't know, whatever.
So one thing I learned on this trip was one of Matt's secret skills as a gourmet chef. He was pulling out these amazing meals. He was making bannock that was crusted in Parmesan, fennel, and different herbs, and
yeah, sweet.
These chicken curry dinners that were just delicious.
Yeah,
and I always joke about Alex with his meals. Last year he brought a lot of nuts, and we were having like a lot of nuts and like milk. So it was funny, and we joke about it. Like the the variety of meals we have out there, from nuts and milk to these pan crusted bannocks.
How much fish were you eating? Did you have good fishing?
You know what? The fishing wasn't amazing.
Really?
Yeah. So the big thing was there's a lot of pike in the lakes.
Yeah.
And I feel like they outcompete a lot of the brook trout fishing.
Yeah.
And, you know, we much rather catch brook trout than a pike. But yeah, we were catching actually a lot more pike than right. brookies. And the brookies weren't that big.
Right.
But at the same time, we weren't fishing a lot of the time too. So I find on these burly river sections,
yeah.
where we'd spend an entire day lining and paddling rapids,
yeah.
we have all our gear so tucked away that if we wanted to fish, it's a process. You'd have to take it out, you'd have to set it up. And a lot of the time we just said, fuck it. We just want to get down the set. And by the time we get to the camp, we're tired. And fishing is usually put on the back burner for the day.
Right, right. No, it's true. You need to do like a chill lake trip for, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's when the fishing is good.
Or have more time. I feel like we were pretty...
I felt like we were rushed on our trip. That was the other thing. Feel like I would have liked to have had an extra week. Just because it makes it stressful. You're just like always worried about making distance. And
yeah, that was the same with our trip. So we knew the guys were arriving 17 days later from our start.
Right.
So we had that timeline in the back of our head. And there's a lot of uncertainties we had to deal with, like height of land crossings and this river called the Seneca River, which we had to go up about 80 kilometers.
Yeah.
And we didn't have any information on it, so we didn't know if it was going to dry up, if the rapids were too tough to track, if we had to portage. So there's a lot of uncertainties that when we had downtime, we would just continue, we'd push a little farther each day.
Right.
And it's good that we did, because we had a couple of rest days, but we definitely did those rest days after how hard that upper section was.
Right. What was the 80 kilometers upstream like?
So we did two height of land crossings on the upper section because we were going east,
yeah,
essentially following the Labrador Quebec border. We had to cross all these watersheds of these rivers that were going south. So the first one was leaving a Tikkanaq Lake and heading over to the Romaine watershed, the Romaine River.
Right.
It's known for having great whitewater. It's almost as well known as the Moise is in terms of North Shore rivers.
Yeah.
But in 2019, a large hydroelectric complex was built there and has been dammed.
Did it fuck it all up?
Yeah. So you can't paddle it anymore.
Oh shit.
But we had to still portage into the upper sections and paddle that river.
Right.
So the Seneca was a tributary that poured into the Romaine that we would take up to push ourselves east to get to the Agouniche watershed, which sits between the Romaine and the Natashquan.
Right.
So this tributary, a lot of these northern rivers, it's really hard to find information.
Sure.
Because I find a lot of these people that travel them, they don't necessarily share them online.
Right.
So it's very tough to know if it's been traveled in the last 50 years, if it hasn't, if there's information available. But for this specific river, we couldn't find any information.
Right.
And 80 kilometers is a decent amount.
Not insignificant, man.
No. So what we had on our side was there was lakes on the way.
Okay.
And we knew if we get to these lakes, we could crush 5, 10, 15 kilometers pretty quickly.
Right.
But between these lakes, there are these narrow blue lines.
Right.
That you never know, right?
So what did you run into?
So I was very optimistic going into it. I found a lot of the time on the trip, I was optimistic about what we could do. And Matt was a little more cautious.
Right.
And it would go either way. Sometimes I was right. Sometimes Matt was right. Matt was definitely right on this river.
Oh, shit.
We were talking about this river for a few days because we knew there was an unknown. And we need to take this river to meet the guys in a few days. And I was under the impression that we could just track our canoes up the river. And tracking your canoe is essentially you walk on the shoreline and you walk your canoe like a dog in the current, and you just work the angles and you can essentially just travel up these rivers. Mm-hmm. But we get there and this river is pouring into the Romaine, and we tracked for about 500 meters and the river started to narrow and all this volume got choked into these chutes.
Oh, tough.
The alders started choking the shoreline, and it was just too treacherous. So we had to start portaging. Whew. But a lot of the portages here on this section, the forest was really thick.
Yeah.
And it was densely packed with these spruce that were...
Man, alders, man. Portaging through alders is the worst.
Yeah, there's no easy way. And especially when these trees are fallen too. And this area of the plateau, there's a lot of loose rock.
Yeah.
And it's just blanketed in moss, and you can't necessarily see where the loose rocks are, where the holes are.
Right.
And this is still pretty early on the trip, so we're carrying a lot of heavy packs, balancing on rocks and trees. And it was short portages, but they were like extremely difficult. And you needed to be so focused on every footstep so you wouldn't slip and fall. And not only would you fall, but you'd fall with an 80-pound pack on your back.
Yeah, brutal.
Yeah.
So the 80K took you how long?
3 days.
Yeah, I mean, 3 days of hard work, I bet.
Yes. So eventually, how these height of lands work is the height of land itself is not what you think. It's not like a mountain range.
No.
It's typically a bog.
Yeah.
And the water drains from these bogs, and as they go farther away, they pick up momentum.
Right.
So when we started at the outflow of the Senecal, there was a lot of water, but the farther we got up, the current was less strong.
Yeah.
So we were able to eventually start tracking the boats and lining and waiting with the boats. So the worst day was that first day on the river when our world collapsed, when we realized this is going to be incredibly hard.
Right, right.
But luckily for us, it got a little easier the farther we got to the height of land.
Right.
If it didn't, we probably wouldn't have saw the guys on time.
Man, yeah, paddling upstream, that's tough. It's like when I was prepping for our trip, I read Adam Schultz has got a book. Can't remember the name now. Cross the something. Do you know Adam Schultz?
Yeah, so is it the book where he went through the Arctic?
Yeah, he started somewhere in the Yukon and ended like way over in Nunavut.
It was a ridiculously long trip.
He
went up the Mackenzie using the winter's advantage.
Yeah, he went up the Mackenzie, and the whole time we were going down this thing with like 6, 7, 8 kilometers of current, I was like, man, this guy's crazy. He pulled. And it does have like, you know, it's such a big river, you can be in pretty close to shore, and there's like pretty good bottom. Man, he was doing like a lot of distance poling upstream, and he went a long way. Like, he started in this place called Sigachik, which is the second little community we went through, which isn't far from where we ended in Inuvik. And he went all the way up to Fort Good Hope, where this town we went through, which probably going downstream, that took us 7 days. And he pulled up. I think he did it like pretty quick. I think he probably did it in like 12.
That's ridiculous.
He was flying upstream. Yeah.
I heard that he brought a tarp or something, and those heavy winds that you're talking about, actually harnessed the wind.
Yeah, he made a sail.
And was able to sail up current.
Man, this is these prevailing winds. Like they were working for him because they were on our nose like most of the trip. But I still find it hard to believe that you could overpower 6 or 7 kilometers of current.
He does some trips that I can't even understand.
Yeah, respect. Yeah, respect to him. Respect man. To Adam. Because then He like came out of the Mackenzie and went up. It's called the Hare Indian or the Hare Rabbit Skin, or I can't remember. It flows into the Mackenzie at Fort Good Hope. He went up there and got into Great Bear Lake, which is this massive lake. You know, it's like not quite as big as Great Slave, but it's huge. And then he paddled all the way across Great Bear, and then he went up the Coppermine, which sounds even crazier. The Coppermine's flowing at a quick clip. And he paddled up the Coppermine for like several hundred kilometers. He did a lot of that trip. He was paddling against the current until he got into the Thelon. And then he went out to Hudson Bay, which is, man, that's the trip. My next trip, I think I want to do the Thelon. I want to paddle from Yellowknife to Hudson Bay.
That would be an amazing trip. I would love to do a trip up in Northwest Territories.
Yeah, you should come up. Yeah. You should come up. We should do a trip. That trip would be awesome. It would, it'd be two rivers, big rivers. What's the first one? It starts with an H. Something into the Thelon, and then you end at Baker Lake, which is basically Hudson Bay.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah. And you could paddle from, yeah, like you could paddle along the shore of Great Slave Lake to, have you heard of Pike's Portage?
I have, yeah.
Yeah, you do Pike's like 3 or 4 day portage to get up. That's the height of, basically the height of land to get into Artillery Lake and then downstream to Hudson Bay through pure tundra, you know? All these eskers and like sandy, really nice, like sandy, it's almost sand dunes. It's like, I haven't been there, but I've flown over it and it looks really cool.
Man, as a geologist, I get off on glacial deposits.
Oh man, you would love it. So Dwayne Wolgamuth, who's been on this podcast, I interviewed him and his wife Leanne at they live in a cabin north of Yellowknife. It was awesome. I skied in. It's like off grid, you know, and they fed me bear sausage and then we recorded an episode. It's episode 3 or 4. Anyway, if anyone wants to check it out, they can check it out. He hiked like his expedition, not this summer, like now, but 2020, summer 2020, I think, or maybe 2019, was he hiked the longest esker in Canada. And I think it was like 400 or 500 kilometers long.
I feel like I've heard this before. Was he funded by the RCGS?
Yeah, yeah, he was. Okay. Yeah. Man, he's crazy. Him and Leanne are crazy. Like, I didn't interview him about hiking the esker. I was like more into some of their canoe trips because they paddle with their kids. And like they have a big like 18 or 19 foot boat and they have 2 kids and I think they're about 3 and 5. But they do like 100 day canoe trips with a 3 and 5 year old man. So like I was interested in talking about that, which we did. And but yeah, he's like also done these, you know, big hiking trips and he's funded by the Canadian Geographic Society as well. Like they have done wild trips. They paddled down the Keel. They drove over to the Yukon, paddled down the Keel, which was like a 3 week trip, like Natla Keel, you know, which like for most people is like, that's their trip of the year. But then they were trying to do a trip without flights. So then they got to the Mackenzie and they like shipped the boat home on the barge system or something and then hiked back up to their truck on this, have you heard of the Cannell Trail? It's on this, like, it's an old road that they built from where we started our trip, Norman Wells, like right across the Mackenzie Mountains, like up almost above the Arctic Circle, maybe above the Arctic Circle, right around the Arctic Circle over to the Yukon for World War II to build a pipeline because there's oil in Norman Wells. Anyway, then they hiked back on this old road to their truck. And, like, they did another trip where they canoed all through the Arctic somewhere, ended on the Arctic Ocean, but they were, still several hundred kilometers from a town. So then they just hiked along the Arctic Ocean, like, on the shoreline to get to Pawlituck, which is one of the towns, to get a flight home. Like, right through grizzly. I was like, weren't you guys, like, freaked out about grizzly bears? They're like, no, like, no, we weren't worried.
It sounds like a very interesting man.
Oh man, they're such a cool couple. I'd like to go interview them again because I'm sure they have like. I was just like picking at the you know, tip of the iceberg when I was interviewing them. Yeah, but eskers, he hiked the longest esker.
I'm about to check out that podcast.
Yeah, it was shit audio. Like, I took out my computer, but there was like technical problems. I ended up recording on my phone and like. As we were talking about before we went on air, like I hate recording podcasts with like less than perfect audio. So I apologize to anyone who listens to this show. It's not the best audio, but the content is cool. So yeah, maybe next time I interview him, I'll like haul out all the proper recording gear. And, you know,
it sounds like you could do multiple interviews on this guy.
Oh man, you could for sure. He's like, there's like, you know, Yellowknife's like a pretty canoe centric town. Like you drive around in the summer and like everyone has a canoe on the roof, but there's like levels of badassness. And like, you know, there's like your weekend paddler who just like paddles in the lakes around Yellowknife, and like I would put them kind of at the bottom. And then there's like, I'm not far from the bottom, like compared to other people, you know. Like we're happy to do like 2-3 week trips. We do several 2 week, three week trips. But like relative to some of the people in Yellowknife, like that's nothing. Like he's at like the apex. He's like at the pinnacle and he's in like this league of like crazy paddlers. There's like a crew of crazy paddlers in Yellowknife who like every summer are going on like 100 day trips. Like it's like nothing for them to like do like a 2,000 or 3,000 kilometer trip every summer, you know, through areas that are like so fucking crazy, you know.
Sounds like this is Yellowknife is a place where a lot of these paddlers would flock to because it is a great starting off point.
Well, it is. It's like probably the best. If you're into canoeing and fishing, it's probably the best place in the world. Because you're like, you know, in any direction from Yellowknife, like the neck, Edmonton's the next city, and it's like 1,500 kilometers away, man. You know?
I got to get up there. I've yet to be to the Northwest Territories.
Man, you should come up. We should do a trip 2022.
Yeah, let's do some things.
Short break, top up our drinks, come back on.
Let's do it.
All right. Pause button. We'll be right back. Back to your trip, which is, you know, primarily why I'm having you on, because I wanted to talk about your picky brain, about your trip. How was the crew? How was the group? Before, crew of four, were you guys like two and two, or were you swapping through different paddling with a different guy every day? Like, fill me in on the group dynamics.
Yeah, so there's four of us. I grew up with Alex and Eric. And Matt and I met a couple of years ago here in Nova Scotia. So we all knew each other. And the biggest thing with these trips is you never know how your team dynamics are going to work, right? Because you're forced to be with someone for 24/7 in very uncomfortable situations that are high stress. So sometimes this can break a relationship, or sometimes this can make it a lot stronger.
For sure.
And I can't say enough about our team. We had an amazing team for this. We meshed so well. This was Matt's first large trip. Before this, the longest trip he did was 4 days.
Man, did it blow his mind? And he went for the full month.
He went for the full month.
Did it blow his mind?
Yeah, so I got a kick out of when we were driving up. We crossed the ferry of the St. Lawrence, and we're driving up the North Shore. And if you haven't been to the North Shore, there is big mountains up there. And seeing his reaction as we were driving through that was it made the trip.
Yeah.
And knowing where we're going to spend the next month living out there. And he took on every challenge with open arms. He was a trooper. We had a lot of testing moments, and Matt and our entire team dealt with everything amazingly.
Yeah. Cool. Do you have a leader, or is it like you're working on consensus basis? Like, how's that working?
It's definitely a democracy out there.
Yeah.
It's like, we all think very similar too. Like, we all have our own personalities, which adds value to the team dynamics. But if someone doesn't want to do something, you're not going to force them to do it. And the same goes, like, some, like, typically two or three of us would agree with an option, and then it's probably the better option, right? Like, right. We're all civilized people, and we're all friends, and we all just wanted to stay safe and have fun out there. So we were all on the same page, which was great.
Yeah. Oh, that's how I've done a few trips with four. I think four is, it's a great, great number, man. You like, you can kind of fly through the wilderness. You're efficient. You know, when you get six, eight, you're slow. You're like, just inevitably you're going to be slow.
Yeah. And the safety factor too, with two boats.
And the safety factor. Like, so I've done a lot of trips, just one boat, Rupa and I, but we do dial back the Mackenzie's not a dangerous river. It's a big river, but it's not a dangerous river. Like last year we did the Beaulieu again, more technical, and chance of getting into trouble was higher, but still not like, not the stuff you're doing where like you're doing like ascents that you descents where you basically don't know what it's around the corner, you know, like, that's why four is great. You know, you're like, you got a crew hanging around the fire each night. You have that backup in case something happens. But you'd not... I met this woman in Yellowknife. It's pretty cool. She went on a trip with like some part of the Dene First Nation. And it was a big trip. They like went from this place called... what was it called? forget, this little community to this other community, but it was like 200 kilometers and there was like 60 people.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Like a traveling convoy, man. And I was like asking her about
how do you camp? How do you find campsites?
This like, you know, they kind of all camp in like generally the same area. They shot a moose and they just ate the moose. 60 people. You just like, they just had a moose for dinner.
Yeah, I guess you could do that with so many mouths.
But like, you know, she said they were moving really slow. Like, cause you know, you're only as fast as your slowest canoe, you know?
Yeah.
So I think four. Four is a good number.
Yeah. The safety factor and speed. But also for the whitewater sections, you're asking if we switched boats. We kept it, Matt and I in one boat and Alex and Eric in the other boat.
Yeah.
Because Matt and I were already in sync and our communication was locked in for the last 2 weeks. And Alex and Eric are also coming from Ontario and they did a big trip up to James Bay last year.
Oh, is it the same? I watched, I spent a couple weeks in quarantine in April and I watched that series.
Yeah. Flow to James Bay.
Yeah. Yeah. Great series.
Great series. It's a trip that Alex and Eric took.
And it was Eric's first trip. Right?
Eric's first northern big whitewater trip.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Cool. So he came on this trip.
Yeah, sweet. Yeah. So he came on this one as well. So they have a background of working well together too. So we just kept it that they were in one boat, Matt and I were in the other boat, and that worked out great for us.
Cool, man. How is Northern Scavenger going? You guys seem like you're doing great. Like,
yeah, it's still
the content's awesome.
Well, I appreciate that.
I met a guy the other day, who one of my longtime buddies. He messaged me and he's like, man, I was just watching scallop diving videos and you're in one, like my favorite one. It's like Northern Scavenger's getting around.
Yeah, it's funny the connections and the people that reach out. It is starting to get around, especially in Nova Scotia.
Yeah.
It's the passion project. Alex and I both love just making videos and sharing them.
You're pretty successful. Like, you know, you're in a league of like, you know, you're playing in the same league as Justin Barbour and Jim Baird, and, you know, not that many of you.
Yeah. And this spring, we did get a lot of videos out. We were consistent.
Yeah.
We try to get a video out every week.
Yeah.
But since we went on this big trip, we kind of stopped posting because we're out there filming and paddling, but
you were in like content generating season.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have no reason to stop. Like, we're going to keep moving forward and making videos for everyone.
Yeah.
And I'm very excited to share this video series coming up.
Yeah.
It should be good.
Man. And you're going to do it in like a mini, like episode by episode.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that model.
Yeah. So similar to, Boreal to Barrenlands.
Yeah.
I find a lot of the time people do these big trips to make a documentary, an hour long documentary.
Right.
But, we like sharing the nitty gritty like of every day, and you really get into, feels like we want to share our experience to make it feel like our viewers on the trip with us.
We talked about this last time you were on the show. Like, I love that about YouTube, you know, like if you were working for a producer on some network, like the Outdoor Network or something, you could never get away with just like 5 minutes of hanging by the campfire with like some guys shooting the shit about the day. Like, just let the camera run, you know? But like, I love YouTube for that. I love watching your channel. I love watching Justin Barbour. I love watching Jim Baird, because that's what happens. You know, you get like a 30-minute episode. It's for one day of, instead of the whole trip, it's just one day, maybe a 45-minute episode. And you just like, you know, I find myself like watching them, but you're like, you know, I'm like not fully paying attention. I'm like maybe doing a little bit of work or like sending an email to somebody, but it's like on in the background. It's just like, I don't know. It's like relaxing content, man.
Yeah, it's a different type of experience than a Netflix documentary, for sure.
For sure. It's like, you know, but it's I don't know, it's great. And you do feel like you're on the trip.
And that's one of my favorite parts about editing. A lot of people ask, like, do you like actually making the video? I really do. I love trying to portray the emotions that we felt on the trip to the audience.
Right.
And that's, I get a kick out of that. And that's why I'll continue to make these videos, because it's so much fun and it has that creative aspect where I'm trying to share with you
right
how I felt on the trip.
Right. Which is not easy to do. you know,
and that's where the fun and the challenge comes
in. It's such a personal experience.
Yeah.
When this trip on the Mackenzie, I had a book. I read a few books on the trip, but one of them was called Disappointment River, which is about a guy who paddled down the Mackenzie. It's one of those books like...
Wasn't that Alexander Mackenzie?
Well, yes and no. So Alexander Mackenzie paddled the Mackenzie. He was the first, like, you know, explorer, like Western explorer to paddle the Mackenzie. And the book is about it was written by this man. It's a great book. This guy named Brian Kastner, who's an American guy, who paddled the river. And then, like, it's one of those books where, like, one chapter is about his experience, you know, like, it's kind of like a memoir of his journey. And then the next chapter will be like a historical account. And then the next chapter will be, you know, back to his experience on the river. But like, he nailed it. Like, as he was like describing all of the struggles of his trip, and he paddled the whole thing. He was like a 6 week trip, 2000 kilometer, 6 week trip. But like, I was just like, we were going through the same thing and I was reading about it and I was like, man, this guy nailed it. It's like such a good book. I really encourage anyone to read it. And the historical account is also fucking crazy, man. That's what Mackenzie, I didn't realize this. Mackenzie called it Disappointment River.
He's trying to get to the Pacific.
Yeah. He was looking for a trade route, like a river that flows west, which the Mackenzie does flow west for its first, like, till it gets to like Fort Simpson and then it cuts north. Like the first 300 kilometers, it flows due west. And he was like convinced he was onto it.
Imagine the disappointment he had when he flowed out into the Arctic.
Oh man. Yeah. And then turned around and had to paddle all the way back.
That's insane.
What's crazy is he did that trip in like, I forget now, either the late 1700s or early 1800s. And when he arrived at the Arctic Ocean in July, like the height of summer, it was frozen over completely. And he was disappointed because, like, he was looking for a way to get fur out of kind of like the Athabasca region, like northern Alberta, southern Northwest Territories, where there was like crazy. By like the time, this was like a point in the fur trade where Quebec had kind of been like picked clean. Quebec and like Ontario had been kind of picked clean, so like people were going further afield, like into Athabasca. The Athabasca region was like the next hot spot. But then the problem there is like no one knew how to get it from there out to a ship without taking it all the way back to Montreal. So he was looking for a route to salt water. So when he got to the Arctic Ocean, it was like completely frozen over, and he was disappointed because like you can't get a ship in there. Man, if you go to where Tuktoyaktuk, where the ocean, the Mackenzie spills into the Arctic Ocean now in July, there is not a piece of ice to be seen. It's crazy. Like it's just like, I talked about this shifting baseline syndrome on this show before with a different guest, Mike Lancaster, but like in your own lifetime, it's like, you can't really appreciate climate change. When you read like an account that's like 250 years old, you're like, whoa. You know, the world was a different place, man.
It puts it into perspective.
For sure, yeah. Yeah, it's great, but anyway, great book. And when we were done the river, I was like so impressed with it, I emailed the author, Brian Kastner. I was like, man, you nailed the book. He wrote back. He's such a nice guy.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
That's great that he responded back.
He responded back. He was like, because like we stayed in a cabin. The other cool part about the Mackenzie is because there are communities along the way.
Yeah.
And the boat... Or the river is navigable by motorboat. Like, well, in fact, big ships go up and down the river. We didn't see any, but like they do. So people have cabins like up and down the river, like pretty far from these communities. Like there might be a cabin like several hundred kilometers from a community. And we spent one night at the same cabin that he spent a night at. So I emailed him, like, just letting you know the cabin's still there.
So when would he have done this trip?
I think like 2010.
Okay.
It's not like a super old book. But yeah, it's a cool book. Yeah. And this cabin we stayed at was, man, it was such a lifesaver. Like we were just kind of beat when we got there, you know, and then we show up and this cabin is like immaculate.
And it was unlocked? And
We had been told where the key was.
Okay.
I would say half the cabins were unlocked on the trip and the other half were open. This one was locked, but this was like after we had gone through Fort Good Hope. Man, like I talked about how the people of Fort Good Hope were so generous. To give you an example, it's 500 people. It's a small town. We arrive and we just like paddle into Fort Good Hope. And there's like people like hanging out down by the riverfront because they have like a little staging area for all their boats, like motorboats and canoes and stuff. And this guy, Chris, shout out to Chris Jackson. He like is just hanging out there because he is going boating later in the day. And he's like, what are you guys doing? We're like, oh, we're paddling to Inuvik. We started at Norman Wells. He's like, you must need to go to the store, which we did, because like we knew we were going to go through Fort Good Hope, so we didn't carry a full like 2.5-3 weeks of food. We carried just enough to get to Fort Good Hope. More than enough to get there, but like we intended on resupplying. And we're like, yeah, like where's the store? He's like, oh, it's far. It's at the other end of town, which it was. Like, it was like 2 kilometers away. He's like, here, take my quad. And he's like, how long are you here? And we're like, oh, we're going to like, can we camp up like anywhere to camp? He's like, oh yeah, you can camp up. Like there was camping right there. He's like, well, you can have my quad for as long as you want. Like he just gave us the keys to a quad. We had a quad we were there for one night. We had a quad for like 2 full days. And then he's like, what are you doing for dinner? And we're like, I don't know. Like we were just going to buy some stuff at the store. He's like, nah, fuck that. Like come over to my house. Like I'll make steaks. And he like steak dinner, hot showers.
Oh man,
man, he was the nicest guy. And then his dad is like this famous old trapper. There's a video on the National Film Board about his dad. It's a guy named Wilford Jackson, who is also like kind of plays a role in Brian Kastner's book. And his dad had built these cabins downriver, and he's like, when you get down to that part of the river, like stay at our cabin, which we did. So man, like the people, I feel for the man right now. They're having like a bad COVID outbreak in Fort Good Hope, and they're such nice people.
Yeah, I find in this when you get to a small community, you never know how they'll like perceive you,
right?
And I've never really been disappointed. It's always open arms, just genuine people up in the north.
Yeah. Oh man, like. We were the first people canoeing in that year, and I don't know if anyone came in behind us. Probably not. Like, it's kind of slow tourism up north, you know, because like a lot of people who come up to do these trips are like people from Germany or, you know, Europeans or whatever, Americans. Like, there's none of that going on. So everyone was just like so impressed that we had canoed there. So like,
I'm sure.
I feel like you get some credibility, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, man, tell me, when we were off air, you were mentioned something about the lake names on your trip. Fill me in.
So a lot of the lake systems that we were going through had these ridiculously long names, like 10-syllable Innu names that I could not pronounce, like not even close.
Right.
And doing a little more research, so going back, Innu is a type of are nomadic people, so they would spend the summers following their food source, traveling thousands of kilometers, hunting caribou,
right,
following these herds. And they would name lakes and river systems not based on historical figures, but they're very utilitarian,
mm-hmm.
And would name them based on georeferences. So it would be a descriptive phrase to explain an area that they could tell their buddy.
Oh, yeah.
So a lake would be called the place where the Burbot are, right, or the place that has the two big round mountains.
Right.
So it's a description in Innu that when it's translated to a map, it's compressed into this really long name.
Right.
And
I kind of, I'm interjecting briefly, like when I'm on a trip and you're like on the map, you're like going into Trout Lake. You're like, oh yeah. There's going to be fucking trout in this lake, man.
Yeah, but like we had no idea what these names meant.
Right. Anyway, carry on.
And it was just cool. Just after you travel an area, you have a little more intimate relationship with
for sure
with the land there.
Yeah,
and it's cool going back and and doing a little more research on things that you saw out there.
Yeah.
And names, and doing a little more research on the NU and the trappers that used to be on the land.
Yeah.
It was a very cool experience.
So is that Innu territory at like the northern part of your trip, or even all the way down?
So that entire area, like the Labrador Peninsula, inland is Innu. You have the Naskapi a little more north.
Yeah.
And the Montagne a little more south.
Yeah.
And traditionally, for the last 10,000 years, they were using the entire area as traditional hunting and fishing and traveling grounds.
Right.
So we were all through their territory through
cool.
the trip.
Cool. One of the kind of something I want to explore, and I think there's going to be more episodes on this show about it, is these Innu in Scotland. Have you heard about this?
You were mentioning it earlier, but I find that fascinating.
Man, it's so... You know, it kind of reverses the whole... I'll back up for people who don't understand what I'm talking about. In like the early 1800s, there were a number of recorded observations of... They didn't know, the Scots didn't know that it was Innu, but people kayaking in boats that looked strange. And they like, you know, the descriptions match what we now know as people who are Innu in Scotland. And then in like the early 1800s, a guy washed up ashore and was like ashore for like alive for like 2 days before he died. But like no one could communicate with him. But they kept his boat, and his boat is still in Scotland. And it's a fucking kayak, man. It's like sealskin kayak. Like, there's no question that this guy was Innu. Which like raises a whole number of questions. Like, how did this guy paddle, assuming he paddled, but like, how else did he get there? From probably Greenland, but potentially Labrador, to Scotland. Like, how the fuck did that happen? You know? And like, it flips this whole like, Western movement of humanity from Europe over to the Americas, like on its head. We have people also going east to west.
How long of a rip would that have been for them?
From Greenland? Oh man, like I mapped it out. It's like you can paddle from Greenland to Iceland. It's like somewhere around 1,000 kilometers. You can go from Iceland to the Faroes, which is also somewhere around 1,000 kilometers. Like nothing in between. In the North Atlantic, man, like a nasty body of water. And then from the Faroes to Scotland, northern Scotland is where these sightings were. It's less than 1,000 kilometers, but it's still far.
That's crazy.
It's crazy. It's like, man, I'm going to, like, without spilling too many beans, I'm going to explore this issue more on this show. But, yeah, it just blows my mind, man. Like, these people, you know, like, Rupe and I we made a trip to Nunavut, geez, 2019, you know, and, like, you're just, like, walking around there, like, these people survived in the harshest environment, man.
Harshest.
Like, nothing grows, you know, like living in a crazy place. And like that, like so many interesting things about the Innu, man. Like they were eating, like, you know, everyone now is all like, you know, Joe Rogan's all about like he eats meat, like an all meat diet or whatever. And it's like, I don't know, it's all kind of hokey to me. These guys were like getting all their vitamins and nutrients from like an all meat diet.
Yeah, and that was one thing that Europeans didn't understand when they came here, where the Inuit were eating everything raw, and they're boiling everything.
And they got scurvy. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, just pull that a little closer to your... there you go. Yeah, so anyway, I've been impressed by that culture, man. It's cool, because in Yellowknife, where I spend a lot of time, it's a real melting pot, Yellowknife. You get like the Métis, you get the Dene, who are like... you know, traditionally from the area around Yellowknife, but then because it's the regional capital, there's a lot of Innu people as well who, like, you know, from northern Northwest Territories and into Nunavut, who have to,
yeah,
they end up living there because it's like the regional hub. So it's cool. You just like end up hanging out with a lot of them.
It's humbling knowing the stamina and endurance they had to do. To travel an area with limited gear. Like we go through, we have bug nets, we have bug spray, we have dry bags, we have $800 tents. We can live pretty comfortably out there, but I can't even imagine the conditions they had to deal with. Yeah. You know, like it's.
And man, like they were ruthless. Like on, in this in the this book about the Mackenzie Disappointment River. As I said, for us to do 100 a day, we were like, it was a big day, you know. They would like not consistently, but frequently do 200 kilometers a day downriver, but still, like, fucking the distance these guys were covering. And they had so Mackenzie, and he had like, I think we'd call him Coeur de Bois, like French Canadian, you know, I don't know what the word is, but like, yeah, you know, trappers, French Canadian trappers who were in Mackenzie's boat, but then they also had indigenous kind of guides, but who also served as the hunters, because like the Europeans were useless at hunting. So these like indigenous guys would kind of stay behind and like hunt all day and then catch up at night to meet them for dinner so they could have food. So these guys were not only paddling 200 kilometers a day, they were also hunting all day. Not all day, but like hunting for a few hours a day and then catching up to paddle 200 kilometers in the day.
That's ridiculous.
It's like fucking crazy, man.
Jeez, I can't even imagine. It's such a far-fetched thing to what we do today.
Yeah, they were living a different life.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier in this episode that the area you were in, like, it was the reservoir, was the Joey Smallwood Reservoir?
Yeah, so just north of us, what was this? Was the monster Smallwood Reservoir.
Do you know much about him?
I don't know much.
Man, he's a pretty interesting character too. He was the first premier in Newfoundland, I think. There's a good book about him. Man, I'm forgetting everything tonight. But he was like this charismatic guy. And like before he became premier, he worked... What's crazy is like he started as a union guy. He was like a... He worked for the unions, you know, like he walked the fucking rail line around Newfoundland from like little village to little village, like drumming up union support to like build the union and stick it to the man. And then he became this like very charismatic premier, like quasi corrupt, but also like the benevolent, what's the word I'm looking for? Like he was quasi, not dictator, but like, the dictator with good intentions, you know?
Yeah.
But then he like flipped completely, and he like the last half of his life, he like was trying to crush the unions from this guy who like, he literally walked around Newfoundland, like trying to drum up union support. But he just has this crazy legacy. Like this is what like Newfoundland only became independent, or like it was independent, but only became part of Canada. Like his first premier was only in the 50s, you know? But grew up in poverty. Kind of worked his way, you know, was like a real scruffy guy, worked his way through. But yeah, he was I forget the name of the book, man. It's a pretty famous book. But he was an interesting guy.
There's a huge reservoir named after him now. You know. And the lake systems out there are they look like oceans. They're huge.
Right.
Yeah. We paddled two big lakes along the way on the upper section. Lac Joseph and Tikkanak Lake.
Yeah.
And each of them were, it's nothing like Great Slave up in the Northwest Territories, but 40 kilometers across these lakes.
Yeah, enough that you don't want to get caught.
No. So we were really lucky with weather. We were going through that heat wave that right. was going across the country.
Yeah.
So when we were paddling these big lakes, it was almost like glass calm, balmy conditions.
Yeah, so nice.
We got so lucky.
What's the camping like on that like upper half of the trip? Is it like nice? Do you get nice kind of Canadian Shield, big open granite, or is it like thick, schnarby, gross? Can't hard to find anywhere flat and with no trees.
You know what? We camped on beaches almost every night. Nice. White sand beaches.
Really?
Yeah. To the point where I despise beaches now.
It's just the sand gets into everything.
Sand is on everything. It's and we always pulled up wet from waiting in the water all day, and right. we would just be sugar coated like a donut. Right. With sand.
Yeah, sand does find a way of getting into everything.
Yeah, and cooking on a beach too. You start getting strategies on like how to keep sand out of your meals.
Right.
But compared to the alternative of sleeping in the lab tea with the bugs, oh, it was a great reprieve.
For sure.
Yeah.
Were you cooking on open fire? You take a stove or?
Every night we were cooking on an open fire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, the way I prefer to go, but man, like I've done a few trips now where you're like up in the land at 24 hour sunlight. It's just like the last thing you want to do is like sit by a hot fire when the sun's like you're already sunburnt and the sun's beating down on you.
Yeah.
Stove is nice.
Yeah, we had one day where it was so hot and we were camping on caribou moss that, you know, caribou moss, when it gets hot, it becomes crunchy.
Yeah.
And a huge fire hazard.
Yeah.
That was the one time where it was so uncomfortable and hazardous to have a fire that we had a stove with us too. And
as a backup. How much fuel do you carry on a trip like that then?
Always too much.
Yeah.
So for the two large canoe trips that I did, the cross Labrador trip a couple of years ago, and this one, we've probably had a combined 3 stove boils.
Yeah.
On both trips, and we'd always pack at least a liter of fuel.
Right.
And not even come close to to using it.
Right.
But it's always good to have, because you rather have it and not use it than need it and not have it. You know?
It's like food and getting into the fish.
Yes.
It's like, I always take enough food that I'm not going to eat any fish. Like, I don't need to eat fish. And then inevitably you, except for the Mackenzie, like this last trip, inevitably you catch like so much fish that you don't eat nearly as much food as you brought.
So when you pack food, do you pack on a calorie wise basis or
no.
How do you figure out how much food you need?
I just kind of know like what a portion is, you know, and then just pack like based on portions. Like I don't take like, you know, no, I don't do the math on calories.
Did you lose weight on this trip?
Yeah.
How much?
Not a huge amount, but like 6 pounds maybe.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. That man, I lose weight every canoe trip. Like it's pretty hard not to lose weight.
And that's the best thing. You can eat as much as you want. Yeah. You can lose weight on these trips. It's the ultimate weight loss program.
Yeah, man. Like I saw a post from Justin Barbour, like just on Instagram the other day where he like had the before and after. He lost a lot of weight.
Yeah. Matt lost, I think he's at 17 pounds right now. He's down 17 pounds.
On a month long trip. That's a lot, man.
Yeah. He looks like a new man after that trip.
Really?
Yeah.
Were you doing a fair bit of portaging?
Yeah, it's hard work.
I find when like this Mackenzie trip didn't have the same portaging as the trip we did last summer. So like it's still a lot of work paddling, but like you're not using your legs really. It got to the point where like we were spending so many hours in the canoe when like I kind of felt like my legs were atrophying a bit. Like I wasn't using them. Like I was using them less than I wanted to. To a few times where I like would just like there was like kind of high riverbanks I'd like hike up and back down because I needed to use my legs.
Yeah.
But like if you're not using your legs, it's like you're not getting like crazy exercise, you know? Like your legs are the big muscles in your body.
Yeah.
But like our trip, not this summer, but last summer was like portage heavy. And like, man, it's like way more work when you gotta do a lot of portages.
Call me crazy, but I enjoy a good portage.
Man, I miss this trip. I was like, I miss a good portage. It's just like breaks up the day. You like kind of huck all your gear over. It's like, I don't know, you feel like you get all sweaty and you like, you feel like you did something.
Yeah.
And then like paddling is such a nice break that's why this trip was like mentally tough. When you're just paddling like 10 hours a day, it gets so fucking tiring, man. Especially when like, there'd be these long, I said we had a few sets of rapids, but there'd be like long stretches where like you're just paddling to the next point and it's like 20 kilometers away. You're just like, oh my God, I can't wait to get there.
Yeah. We had a ridiculous portage on this trip. That I would say is the climax of storytelling of our trip. So,
well, fill me in, man. You're on the radio, so
all right,
you're good.
So, So we knew there was this huge canyon coming up, right? So this is the lower section of the river. We probably had maybe 3 or 4 more days of travel. And so this river, you're going down this mountain range and you go over waterfalls, you go over chutes, but there's this one section where it's a canyon. And we knew from Guy Dorr and Christian Houdon's trip notes that you do not want to go down this canyon. because there's multiple waterfalls.
Okay.
And you can't escape once you're in there.
No.
Because of the sheer rock cliffs.
Yeah, man. That honestly is like my biggest fucking fear paddling is getting into a position where you can't get out.
Yeah. It's not a situation you want to be in.
No.
Especially in a remote place.
Yeah.
So we knew this and we knew we had a portage. We expected it to be about a day, a full day portage to do the kilometer, 2 kilometer carryover.
Right.
So we're paddling up to this canyon and we just see these sheer rock faces just elevate along the shoreline. And all we can see is this rock face with these thick, this thick forest about 200 to 300 meters up. And we're like, fuck, like this is going to be fucked if we can't find old signs of a portage trail.
Right.
So we knew from Guy Dorr's notes and Christian Huda's notes that River Wright, the Aguinish trappers used to skirt the mountain on a portage trail. And if we could find this route, this is our best option because this is some thick forest, man.
Yeah.
And it is not flat terrain. So we're pretty intimidated coming up because like this is a,
you don't want to get sucked in.
We don't want to get sucked in, but like we just see how daunting this portage is based on how the elevation we have to gain.
Yeah.
So we were very eager to try to find the Aguinish trappers route.
Right.
So we pull ashore and almost right off the bat, we find an old decaying canoe, a cedar strip canoe.
Okay.
And an old rubber boot.
Really? Why?
Yeah, just sunken in the moss, and we were elated. We thought if we found this, we could find the portage, and we could
right,
and we could use this as our
also kind of eerie
beacon. Yeah, it's like a just lost in time, and it was one of those. This is one of the only times we saw any sort of sign of human.
Yeah,
out there.
Yeah,
but it was definitely a time where we appreciated seeing that.
When you're done telling your story, I'm going to tell you an eerie story about a similar thing. But carry on.
So we scouted a little more. We spent about 3 hours and we couldn't find anything. And this is some of the thickest forests that we've seen on this trip. You couldn't walk. You couldn't move a canoe 5 feet without having to put it down because like the issue was the underbrush was growing in. So you had all these 10-foot spruce trees.
I was gonna say, it sounds like spruce.
Yeah. Yeah. Among larger birch trees and larger spruce.
Yeah.
So, we came to the realization that we had to make our own path around this mountain.
Yeah.
So the canyon goes about a kilometer downriver, but we had to skirt up and around this cliff.
Right.
So the only option we had is to blaze our trail because there's no way we could actually just drag the boat because we wouldn't be able to get through.
Right.
So our plan was we'd have two guys blazing trail and two guys portaging gear.
Oh, crazy. Did you have a saw?
We had two saws. Yeah. We brought the Agawa 24 inch and the Agawa 15 inch.
Okay.
And backing up this trip, this portage took 2 full days.
It's fucking terrible.
To get a kilometer down this river. And the issue was that we couldn't just skirt along the riverside. We actually had to go up and around this mountain and we kept getting cliffed out.
Oh shit. Like you'd get somewhere and there'd just be more cliff.
There'd be more cliffs and we couldn't get down. So we were getting farther and farther away from the river.
Yeah, yeah.
So the first day after working 12 hours, four men working as hard as they can, we made it 900 meters.
Oh my God.
It was demoralizing.
Oh fuck. That's terrible.
And it was raining too. So we were soaked. Oh, and shit. What made matters worse was every once in a while we could get a glimpse of the river.
Yeah.
And it was fucking far. it did not make us feel good that we were how far and high we were from this river.
Oh my.
And yeah, so the entire portage took 2 full days of blazing trail. We probably cut over 1,000 trees.
What did you eat for dinner that night?
Dinner?
Yeah.
I don't even remember. Something.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds terrible.
Yeah, it was one of those moments. It was definitely, it was like the last test of the river.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you find the old trail at all?
So right at the end, so how it would work is we'd have two guys blazing trail and then they'd blaze trail, and then they kind of scout to figure out the next 100 meters, sure. like the game plan for the next 100 meters.
Yeah.
So we got to a place where it was Eric and I blazing trail on day two around lunchtime, and we were in striking distance of the end.
Yeah.
So we're like, man, we might as well just go, we might as well get to the end of the river and find the best route back.
Right.
Because when you're blazing trees all day, you get really in tune with the best portaging.
Right.
And there are sections of old growth forest and sections of new growth.
Right.
And the new growth was that thick bush that we wanted.
You want the old growth.
Yeah, yeah. So we were trying to find a route that would get us through like the most old growth forest as possible. So we went all the way to the end, and we get to the end and we find a trail.
Of course, on the other end.
And we were very happy, but we were also like, fuck, like, did we totally miss this trail?
Right.
And we were just blazing a trail through this mountain for no reason. But we followed this trail back, and it did peter out into a burn.
Right.
So we did lose it quickly, but right. it did give us a little extra. We blazed the trail towards a trail that existed rather than towards the river.
Gotcha.
And it probably saved us about 4 hours of travel.
Oh, that's a fair bet.
Which was decent.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you know, the next paddlers who come through will be grateful.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we didn't GPS that route.
Hopefully they find it.
Well, they have no option. It's the only route on the river where you can actually move a canoe.
Right, right. So, and how long? I mean, nature grows back pretty quick, but you've got a few years before it'll be just sucked up by the growth, you know?
It was crazy. We when you're blazing trail all day, you get a little more sloppy with your cuts.
Yeah.
So there was a point where the cuts were maybe 3 feet from the bottom,
right,
from the forest floor. And they're like spikes, and amongst the spikes there are fallen trees, and you had to walk these fallen trees around the spikes. And if you fell, you get penetrated by these cuts, and we're calling them the Vietnamese death traps.
Right, yeah, right. Like the spikes coming out of
it was so dangerous. Like, Godspeed for anyone who takes a sportage in the future, because it's not well maintained.
Fuck, man, you made it.
Yeah, that was one of those moments where. At times we were cursing the route, but looking back, that was definitely
that's type two fat.
That's type two fun. That was character building stuff.
Yeah, the eerie paddling story that you know, like you mentioned, how you washed up and there's just a boot and an old canoe. You're like, what the fuck? My brother was canoeing up in kind of like northern central New Brunswick, like near Mount Carleton, and they like come into a site. And there is like a tent set up, and there's like sleeping bags unrolled in the tent, and there is like cooking gear laid out, and there's like personal shit all scattered around, and not a person to be fucking found. And like, it's clear that this has been like this for a while, because like you can just tell, like, you know, like the food in the pot is like all molded over and shit. And they're just like, what the fuck? And they were so freaked out they didn't camp there. It was like the camping spot they were aiming for, you know? So they didn't camp somewhere else. And they like carried on their trip the whole, it was like just a 3 or 4 day trip. But like the rest of the trip, they're like, what the fuck? Like they carried on to the next site the next day. The rest of the trip, they're like, what the fuck was that, you know? And then they get out, and they immediately like, when they get out, they like immediately like drive into the police station to report it. And the police are like, oh yeah, like a guy had a heart attack there, and his buddy like paddled him out, like, you know, threw him into the boat, paddled him out, get him to the hospital, and you know, no one's gone back to get the shit.
Wow.
But like that, my brother was just like so freaked out. Man, it'd be so fucking freaky, you know?
Yeah, that'd be really like eerie coming up to that.
Totally perfectly sat campsite with just no one in it, and clearly no one's been in it for a long time. Yeah, he was like pretty freaked out for that trip. The whole time they were like, what the fuck, you know, like, are we about to get killed, you know?
Yeah.
By some weird creature or some murderous fucking lunatic.
Yeah, you never know. Seeing something like that, it's something you don't expect. And it's
no.
Pulling up to such like a personal setup too, right?
Yeah, yeah. Noah, we could plug in the computer, but my battery's going to die 4%. Maybe this is a natural point to to cut her off. I could chat all night. But
if I have another beer, I won't be able to drive home. So
yeah, I don't know if the listeners want to listen to us banter for another hour. Thanks for coming on the show. Northern Scavenger, YouTube, Instagram. You guys got a few. How do people find you?
Yeah, so it is Northern Scavenger, like a raccoon. And yeah, I would say YouTube is our biggest channel. Stay tuned this winter, February 2022. We're going to be dropping the video series for the Maze to the Agouniche, our month-long canoe trip that we did this year. So stay tuned for that, and hopefully you follow along.
Man, you guys make great content. I think I owe a lot of my success to you because you were guest number 2 on the show, and you posted that you were on the show, and from then on, there's been people listening to it. So thanks to you. Keep up the good work. Thanks for coming on.
Appreciate it. Thanks, cool. Kyle.